It's time for Mac Geek Gab, and I'll bring us our quick tip of the week because I rediscovered that the Finder, yes, the macOS Finder, with no third-party extensions necessary, will let you batch rename files. It's true. It's a little tricky because it doesn't work the way my brain wants it to work. You highlight all the files, and then you go to the file menu or you right-click and you choose rename. When you are renaming multiple files, you get a little dialogue that pops up and it says rename Finder items, and you can replace text, you can add text, you can remove text, and you put in the string that you want it to find if you're replacing text and the string you want to replace it with. And even better, it uses the first file in the list as an example to show you what your end result will look like. So you actually get to see this in real time. It's the coolest thing. I love that it's in there, especially since it's probably not used very much. More quick tips like this, plus your questions answered today on Mac Geek Gab 1032 for Monday, April 8th, Trading Cards for Grownups Day 2024. Folks, and welcome to Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in, or we provide, quick tips like that. You send in your questions, we try to provide the answers. You send in cool stuff found, we share all that together. The goal being that each of us learns no less than five new things every single time we get together, or we relearn things we've forgotten about, like that opening quick tip, which I know that I knew in the past because the find and replace strings were things familiar to me. Sponsors for this episode include LinkedIn.com/MGG, where you can go and post your first job for free, and BB Edit from barebones.com with integrated notebooks, ChatGPT support. There's so much in there. We'll talk more about all that in a little bit. For now, back here and well rested in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here and never left in South Dakota, I'm Adam Christensen.
And we are flying in the missing man formation, as it were, today, because Pete is actually out doing the flying. So schedules were not to work. So, Adam, you and I are, I think this is the first time you and I are doing this, just the two of us?
I think. I can't remember.
I can't either.
I'm getting older and these things escape me, but I thought we maybe did one.
Yeah.
Pete did swoop in at the last moment.
There was one.
I know we talked about doing one.
There was one we thought we were going to do solo without Pete. And then the schedules just magically worked. So I don't think that's going to happen today. I don't think we're going to see a surprise Pete appearance, but you never know. With Pete, you never know. And I want to thank you and Pete for shouldering the load last week. I know there's visual and audible evidence that I participated in Mac Geek Gab 1031. I have very little recollection of it, given the limited amount of sleep that I had coming in. The one thing I remember about doing this, I do remember doing the show, was that every 10 minutes or so, I'd feel like, oh, okay, now I'm like awake and online. Ah, now I'm great. I'm good. And then 10 minutes later, be like, no, now I'm online. It's like, no. I don't think I was ever online. Alas, thank you. I listened back. I thought there was good stuff in the episode. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. That's good. All right.
Even if you don't remember.
Yeah. I remember now. Like I heard it. It's like, okay. I wasn't even like on anything. It wasn't, you know, there wasn't. It was just lack of sleep, I guess. Yeah. PC Unix, in a thread in our Discord, PC Unix mentioned the idea of having pinned notes in the Apple Notes app. And Steve Hammond was like, I didn't even know this was a thing. Dave, you need to put this in the show. I agree. If we've never talked about pinned notes in Notes before, then yes, now is the time. We use this here, right? With Mac Geek Gab, we have several shared notebooks, which perhaps is another quick tip, that there are shared notebooks. We have several shared notebooks amongst the three of us. And at the top of two of them, the prep notebook and the current show notebook, we have some pinned notes that we use for various things. And it's awesome to be able to just go. Like I have my, I don't know if I've talked about it on the show, but certainly pre-show, I have my pre-flight and then, of course, post-flight checklist because there's too many things to do now with all the stuff that we're doing. I would forget. And in fact, we added a new thing to the pre-flight checklist just this morning because I kept forgetting. Thank you, Zoe, and thank you for the bacon. So, yeah, these pin notes are fantastic. And you just, I think you just right-click a note and choose pin it, right?
Yep. Yep. I'm sure there's something in the menu, and I'm sure there's a shortcut, too, but that's usually how I do it.
Yeah, there is pin notes. There's also lock notes.
Yeah, lock. That's so Pete can't mess with them.
The locked note password one. Password protects it. Yeah, I wish there was a way to lock it so Pete couldn't mess with it. That would be great. Yeah.
Well, if you don't give him the password, he can't mess with it.
Oh, that's true. That's fair. Yeah. But I want like a. Now,
I know what we're talking about. Like, you can't edit it.
It's not so much for Pete, although it is. But also me. Like, you know, sometimes you just like your cursor's where you don't think it is, and you start typing. Yeah. It's like, oh wait, crap! I didn't want to edit that note. Like my pre-flight checklist, I only want to change that when I want to change it. You know. So yeah. Anyway, that's the pin notes. And other things in notes too, evidently. So, yep. Yeah. Yipper. What do we have next, Adam?
I was going to say, Michael has one for us. He says, your advice is excellent. Don't get caught. Well, yeah, that's good advice. He says, he would also like to add this. Don't get lost.
Oh.
He says, here's a quick tip about using the iPhone camera as an aid to not getting lost. Once upon a time, it's the story. I was at a meeting at a local hospital designed as a truly enormous maze on 5 stories. Our team were meeting in a department far from the main entrance. We received a message that colleagues who had traveled from another city had just arrived and were waiting at the main reception. I was volunteered to go fetch them. Finding reception was no problem. It was clearly signposted throughout the building, but I would I ever be able to find my way back? And it would be especially embarrassing to take visitors to an interminable ramble ramble all around the hospital. So this is the quick tip. On my long walk to reception, each time I passed through a junction, I would turn around and snap a photograph back down the corridor I had just taken. Once I had collected my visitors, all I had to do was step back through the photographs one by one in reverse order, and they guided me straight back to our meeting. Our visitors were so impressed.
That's smart. I like it. I have made in scenarios like that, I have made a habit of, as I walk, I haven't used my camera to do it, but I just turn around and look because I know that I, like, the view that I have going the way I'm going is not the view I will have going the other way. So I use that to just set some visual memory of like, oh, yeah, I remember this. I remember this. I remember this. Taking a picture that I actually have and can see would be even better, especially given the whole memory thing.
I don't know if it would work on multiple floors. And this is just coming to me in the back of my mind, and I've never used this feature.
Yep.
But doesn't the Compass app have like a wayfinding thing in it?
Yes. Yes, I haven't used it this way either. Yeah. How do you turn on the wayfinding app?
I don't remember. I think you can use it with the watch and stuff too, but I doubt it would work.
I think it's just on the watch.
Yeah. Altitude wise.
Right. And yeah, is the GPS tight enough to work indoors?
In a building, probably.
Yeah. But I think it's just on the watch. Because I have the Compass app up and I don't see.
Oh, maybe it is only on the watch. Yeah.
Yeah. I did just notice something about the Compass app having it up is I tapped on the screen thinking maybe that'll get me more options. And I swiped and, you know, did other things. But if you tap on, if you aim the compass in a certain direction and you tap on it, it'll mark that. So at the moment I am facing 287 degrees. Okay, great. If I then turn the compass, it shows me the gap between where I set and where I was. So I, you know, it's like it's red. The gap is red. And it says, nope, if you want to aim 287, well, you're off of that now. Better go back onto it. That's
cool.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, there's all kinds of little tips in there. I'm wondering what else.
Yeah, the level.
There's the level, but that's not in the Compass app, is it? No.
Is it now in Measure?
I think it's in the Measure app. Yes, that's right. Yep. Which is perhaps even yet another quick tip if you didn't know that it was there. Yeah, there's that level app. And that's a fun game to play, to hold the phone and see if you can make the screen turn green.
Yeah.
In the level app.
Lots of things.
All right. Yep. All right. Alex has a quick tip for us. He says, I thought maybe sharing a word of advice about for users of the Apple Calendar app to help be better prepared for birthdays of their important people in their lives. Apple Calendar apps provide a convenient feature for events, the second alert on iOS or multiple alerts on the Mac. I'd also like to use it for birthdays of the people closest to me to make sure that during busy days, I prepare a nice and accurate gift or message in advance and to be reminded as well in the morning on the day of the event, ensuring myself from accidentally and unintentionally recalling about the matter too late. However, if you go to settings to change the alert of the automatic contacts birthdays calendar and try to add a second alert for its events, you'll see that this particular calendar is deprived of the second alert feature. I have come up with a manual workaround. In the calendar app on the Mac, double click on a given birthday event, then click the middle gray area of alerts and a plus sign and a circle will appear. This will give you multiple alerts on the Mac. Unfortunately, that doesn't work at all on the iPhone. You can't add the second alert and the alert created on the Mac doesn't fire on the iPhone either. This is truly limited just to the Mac. At least it allows you to do the second alert, which you could set for, you know, several days before or whatever you want. So I like that. That's a good one, Alex.
That's a great tip.
Yeah.
It also reminds me of, I can't think of the examples right now, but I do often run into this thing where there's certain things you can only do on the Mac and not on the iPhone.
Yep.
Like that disparity comes up.
Yep.
More often than I would think at this point.
Yes. Yeah, I more often today than I would expect to. Yeah, you're right, because why? There's so much that's shared between the two, like code bases that are shared between the two of these apps. Why do we have these things? And then we have, you know, cool stuff like the battery name in the Finder. That's like, who even knew? I think there are multiple third party apps to do that.
Oh yeah, there's a ton.
Yeah, there it's ton. Right there. like how many other people don't know? How many other people have either don't know about it or have forgotten about it? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the classic thing though is like the thing in the Finder is pretty basic. I mean, it does a nice job, but like if you need extreme renaming with like a lot of options, there's a lot of great third party apps for that.
Correct.
I mean, correct. Apple always leaves that little hole. They kind of cover the basics, and then if you need more, developers.
Developers, right. Yeah, you're right, because like it doesn't let you sequentially rename things, or at least not that I know of. You can add text to it in the Finder and you can change the format. You can do a counter. Oh, it will let you do a counter with the format thing. So okay. And you could even have it with the date. You can timestamp the files. That's really.
Yeah, it has some nice options.
It's pretty
robust.
Again,
I think there's these extreme ones that just like people who just are dealing with massive amounts of documents need to do weird things.
Other things.
Conditionals and
correct.
Like if it's this, then that, you know, that sort of thing.
That makes sense.
It's not going to do any of that stuff.
It's not going to do that, but it's mess around with it. Like this is one of those things that's, I believe, good to have a working knowledge of, so that when you need to do a thing, you know, I know where to go. And I suppose in a meta sense, that's kind of what this show is all about, because a lot of the things we share aren't like necessary in the moment, but it's like plant the seed in your head Plant the seeds with us, folks.
Yeah. Uncle Jamie has another seed.
Yes. If you want to move on. I do.
Yeah. He says, drag a document's title bar icon to move or share like the Finder. The small proxy icon appears to the left of the document's title in the title bar when the document is open in the app. For purposes of dragging, it has the same effect as dragging the document's icon in the Finder. This is especially useful to attach the document to an email message you also have open. Yep.
Super handy.
I always use the trick too for figuring out the path by like right clicking on that thing, and I think it'll show you the path, right?
Oh yeah, it'll show you the path. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
To where that file is.
Yep. Yeah. It's. I love things like this. All right.
But yeah, just treating that folder thing occurs in a lot of places. There's a lot of places where you can just drag the folder, the representation of that thing in an app, and it will behave like you just grabbed it from the Finder.
Yep.
So I think that's just a good general tip. Like, doesn't even have to be the title bar folder. Like, you know, you're just looking at a document app or something like that, or you're in files or wherever.
Yeah. Yeah. Kiwi Graham in our live chat, Discord, mattgeekup.com/Discord, says he believes that icon is technically called the proxy icon, which works for me. Sure. I'll call it that. I do this occasionally, and the last time I did it, I figured, oh, I need to share this again. I think we've talked about it before, but with current versions of Mac OS, we have this whole permissioning thing for where apps get access to things like your microphone or full disk access or accessibility, especially. And really those last two, full disk access. Whew, I can say Mac Geek Gab in my sleep, as I proved last week. Cannot say full disk access without really working on the enunciation. I got to make that funny face that theater people make. And accessibility, those two are often in the way. And by that, I mean, I'll go to do something in an app and it'll say, oh, you need to re-enable. It doesn't say re-enable, but I know I've enabled it before and somehow it got turned off. So it's like, you need to enable this. And then sometimes you got to quit the app and relaunch it. And so I have found that when I am in that scenario and I have to go into, say, you know, system settings, privacy and security, you know, and then let's say accessibility, if I have to go in there for one app, I look at everything that's there and turn back on the ones that I know that I want on because they turn off. And then while I'm there, I also go to full disk access and do the same thing. And I have gotten in the habit, you know, talk about alert blindness or security blindness, because this is such a cumbersome thing in the moment. I have gotten in the habit of just turning on accessibility and full disk access for anything that shows up in that list, which means it asked for it. Now, obviously, I'm looking at the list as I'm doing it. And if there's something that seems questionable to me, maybe I won't turn it on or I'll dig in deeper. But otherwise, man, like, no bueno. Like, I wish I could say, just grant this like it used to be, please. Like, I'll take the blame. I don't know.
Yeah, but you're a responsible computer user who knows what you're doing.
I try to be.
You know? I understand where this comes from, because it comes from that place of, you know, if they don't point it out to people, they won't think about it. Yep. So it would be nice to have that override, I guess, you know, somewhere. Probably bury that setting deep where most people wouldn't find it. But
even bury it deep. That's right. Yeah, default to on. I'll go in and turn them off. Like, I really wouldn't mind, you know, even setting a monthly calendar thing. Maybe I should do that. But I find myself in there probably about that often, is once a month. I'm in there and it's like, all right, just turn all the stupid stuff on. Like, because it drives me crazy. And another tip about that, when you go and turn, you know, if an app asks you, hey, you need to turn this on or whatever, and you go and you turn it on, system settings will almost, and it might not even be almost always tell you, okay, I've made this change, but you have to quit and relaunch, you know, the app in question in order for it to be aware of this change. That is not universally true. System settings does not know whether an app is truly capable of refreshing itself enough in that way. So try it. Usually with accessibility and full disk access, you do not need, in my experience, you do not need to relaunch the app. For screen sharing, you absolutely need to relaunch the app. And that, of course, is the one that sucks the most when you're like in a Zoom call. It's like, oh, can you share your screen? It's like, oh, crap, that got turned off. It's like, yep, well, I got to say goodbye. I'll be back, you know. So,
well, imagine how fun it is when your IT department is the only people that can change that for you.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't even think about that. Oh. I understand that. That sounds awful. Is that that?
And yeah, and they will not grant it. In my case, for is it Teams? No, what's like, Google's?
Google Meet.
Google Meet. Yeah. So I they're like, no, we're not giving the browser access to your camera.
Oh,
because there's no app, right?
Right. That's
we're not granting Chrome like full access to your camera.
Couldn't they? I'm just thinking about like the right way to solve this problem. Couldn't they say, all right, you're going
to
use
or to your screen. I guess it's really
right.
It's the screen sharing. They don't
want to give access to. What if, and I don't even know if this is possible, but bear with me here. What if they had a like Microsoft Edge and they designated Edge as the browser for these Teams meetings, right? Or Google Meet, or, you know, whatever. Google Meet. And gave you, and this is the part that I don't know if it's doable, but it sure seems like it might be, gave you a locked down Microsoft Edge profile that only allowed it to use Google Meet and nothing else, right? So every time you launch Edge, the only sites that you're allowed to visit with this profile are, you know, meet.google.com or whatever URL is. And then would they feel better about this? Now, I don't know how to go about building that profile or if it's even possible, but it seems like there might be a browser you could do that with.
And it's funny because now that you're saying that, I think they did figure out the solution because I think this came up originally because I was like, hey, I can't share my screen in these Google Meet meetings. And they're like, oh, yeah, well, no, we're not letting the browser do that. And I think my IT guy went and thought about it. And I think he figured out a way. And I now that you say profiles, I think he figured out a way to like build some sort of specialized profile.
Oh, that's good. That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
All right, folks. Ever wonder how we keep our social media game so strong here in MGG land? Well, it's not just tech magic. It's about finding the right crew. Enter our sponsor, LinkedIn Jobs, the secret sauce behind snagging our social media and promotions ninja, Sadie, who's been crushing it here for 3 years now. Imagine scrolling through a digital world filled with over a billion professionals. That's LinkedIn for you. Not your average job board, but a treasure trove of talent waiting to be discovered. And let me tell you, finding Sadie was like hitting the jackpot on a slot machine, except the odds are way better with LinkedIn Jobs. We posted our gig and bam, in less than 24 hours, we had quality candidates lining up like it's Black Friday. And the process? Easier than setting up a wireless router straight out of the box. No tech support needed. So don't get caught in the endless cycle of hiring mayhem. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/MGG. That's linkedin.com/MGG to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring is easy. So easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Go linkedin.com/MGG and our thanks to LinkedIn Jobs for sponsoring this episode. You ever find yourself tangled in code, craving a digital Swiss Army knife to slice through the chaos? Well, our sponsor, BBEdit, is here, wearing its superhero cape, ready to rescue those drowning in a sea of text. Imagine navigating your documents with the ease of a captain steering through calm waters, thanks to BBEdit's new mini map palette. It's like having GPS for your code. And those moments when you're feeling lost, the cheat sheets are your trusty map, guiding you through the murky depths of Markdown and beyond. Now, for my fellow developers, BBEdit's enhanced projects feature is like upgrading from a rowboat to a speedboat. making your workflow smoother and faster. And with ChatGPT worksheets, it's like having a first mate who's fluent in conversational AI, ready to banter back and forth as you conquer the coding seas together. But wait, there's more. BB Edit's got this nifty trick up its sleeve, repeat last command. It's the coding equivalent of an echo in a canyon, but way more useful. And for those venturing into data science, switching between virtual environments is as easy as changing your mind about which Netflix show to binge next. So don't get caught in the undertow of unmanageable text. Arm yourself with BB Edit and navigate the digital waves like a pro. Remember, in the world of tech, being equipped with the right tools isn't just smart, it's essential. Upgrade your arsenal at barebones.com and make text wrangling a breeze. And our thanks to BB Edit for sponsoring this episode. All right. Shall we do some questions, Adam?
Yeah. Andrew's having an issue.
Okay.
That he needs help.
Okay.
He says, here's my issue.
Well,
I am having odd behaviors on my 2019 iMac, a 16 gigabyte, 3.6 gigahertz Core i3. It has a 1 terabyte drive with only about 250 gigabytes used. There are 3 or 4 issues that cause problems. Number one, attempts to use the Finder search result in the Finder become non-responsive and causing them to have to relaunch the Finder. Number two is attempts to search in the Mail app result in the Mail app becoming non-responsive and having to force quit the Mail app. Number three is attempts to print any document to PDF using the print dialog box results in that in the app that created the document to become unresponsive. I'm seeing a theme here.
Yeah, same.
Unresponsive and having to force quit and restart the app. A workaround for this problem is to open in preview and then save the PDF file from there, and that works fine. Number four, attempts to tag a file with a color marker do not work. Troubleshooting steps that he's gone through and have been done to resolve this issue resulted in temporary elimination of these issues, but they return in a matter of minutes or hours. So he's tried Safe Boot. He's tried running Titanium Software's maintenance scripts, which is a great set of scripts, and reinstalling Big Sur from the recovery partition by starting with Command R.
Yeah.
He says, I'm left wondering if there could be some corruption in one or more preference files, but I have no idea which ones might be the culprit. So my first question is, what other repair actions should I take to attempt to resolve these issues on the current iMac and OS? And I think he's also somewhat wondering,
is it time to upgrade?
Yeah, exactly. Do I need a new Mac?
And that was sort of where the question came in. I think maybe the title of the subject of the question was, you know, is it time to upgrade to M1? And I'll address that first. No, not necessarily. It's never a bad time, except that it is, right? It's going to cost you money. All of those things, I had a 2019 iMac Intel here in the studio, similar to what he has. I think mine was a little faster than his, but not to the point where it would make a difference for the things he's talking about. And I would still be using that if it weren't, you know, lightning striked this past summer. I don't think this is the reason to upgrade. There's a few things I'd try if this were mine. I know you said you ran Titanium Software's maintenance scripts. Titanium Software, the folks that make Onyx.
The app.
Yep. I would make sure that for this scenario, especially, that I would go into Onyx, go into maintenance, and turn on everything. And that includes rebuilding the mail index. It definitely includes rebuilding the Spotlight index. There's something, clearly something wrong with Spotlight on this computer. At least that's based, you know, you said you're sensing a theme here. It was like, yeah, same, right? And you know, you already did the Big Sur reinstall over the top. That would have been sort of the next thing that I would try if I were there. Failing all of that, or having tried all of that, because it seems like you might have kind of done the, you know, the obvious things for us, which means either you've been listening long enough or you learn these things on your own somewhere. I would open activity monitor and sort by CPU and make sure in activity monitor, you go to view all processes so that you're seeing the entirety of the system and see what's chewing your CPU in those moments where it's bogged down. It is not uncommon for me. I'm Dave and I'm a nerd. to run with activity monitor open just for these reasons. So I can see what's going on. Or I use, iStat menus or stats or, one of those things that lives in the menu bar. But it is sometimes even clicking on the menu bar is impossible in those moments because things are so bogged down. So having a window open with activity monitor already running, sorted by CPU, showing all processes, that can be really informative for troubleshooting exactly this kind of thing. So that's if I were there, that's what I would do. I don't know. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, so he says he's done a reinstall of Big Sur. I'd be curious if that's just an over-the-top like reinstall, or is that a complete wipe and reinstall?
No, I think that's the extreme, over-the-top. Yeah.
That's the extreme option, and I don't know that you're there yet. At the same time, too, I'm wondering, because I still run a 2019 Intel Mac. I mean,
right.
Mine's a 16-inch MacBook Pro, and I've got a Core i7 instead of an i3. I'm curious why he's still on Big Sur.
He explained that in a part of
the,
in a,
okay.
You didn't miss it. I took it out. He's on Big Sur because he had some issues with a FileMaker database that he didn't want to upgrade. They didn't want to upgrade at the time, but he did say, look, if upgrading to a more recent OS is necessary as part of this, he's like, I don't mind the expense. It's like, we need to solve
the only
problem.
Reason I'm hesitating on that is because it probably doesn't. If you're having these issues, they're not going to go away by doing an overtop install of another operating system. That's kind of what I'm getting at. So if some of the other recommendations you gave didn't work, depending upon, if he's just been doing over the top since he got the thing, I fell in this camp where every 3-4 years I would generally nuke and pave and just restart, because you just build up crud over the years, and it's a pain in the butt, and I hate doing it, and it's not fun, and I recommend it, only in the most extreme circumstances. So I would try some of these other things like Dave's recommended, and if there's not a resolution there, then you might have to bite the bullet and try a nuke and pave. Like, do all your backups, make sure you've got the multiples and you know where everything is and you know where all your software is to reinstall and all that fun stuff. But yeah.
Yep.
Nuke and pave.
I will say that nuking and paving today is way less of a pain than it was even 5 years ago. With so much of our data synced to the cloud, every time I do it, I dread it. Just like you said, it's like, oh, I don't have a day for this, and it only winds up taking a couple of hours, I would be very, if let me put it this way, if I were there on site with you and you were paying me by the hour, and I learned this when I did a lot of this, on site by the hour, I would spend the first 20 to 40 minutes kind of trying the quick things, right? And if we weren't getting anywhere and we were spinning our wheels, it's like, okay, wait, here we are 30, 40 minutes into this. We could stumble on the solution in the next 5 minutes. And that will remain true until we actually stumble onto the solution, which could be hours, but we're always potentially 5 minutes away from the answer. And we might wind up spending 5 hours and not yet get there. So I would always try to balance this with the customer and say, we know that a nuke and pave is probably going to take about 2 hours, or whatever we think it's going to take. That's a known. looking for this needle in the haystack is an unknown. So your choice, but I would advise them, like, if this were my computer, I might spend another 15, 20 minutes looking for the needle in the haystack, and then I would punt on that and just get the job done. And there are additional benefits of nuking and paving that go beyond this one problem, right? But I feel really confident in this scenario, knowing what we know, that a nuke and pave would resolve this. I could be wrong. Yeah, I've been wrong before, but yeah.
The main reason I did it, you know, again, I would do it if I ran into exactly this situation where it's like this problem, I'm just chasing it. I can't figure out what's going on. That's one scenario. The other scenario, like I said, was like every fourth upgrade or something like that, I'd go, yeah, it's really just time.
It's time.
And a lot of that was about just cleaning house. Like, it forces you to go through your system and be like, oh my God, I've got these apps that I haven't needed forever. I have all these documents that have just been sitting there. Let's get those off and archive those someplace else. Like, it gave me an opportunity to like really assess, like, oh my God, I pack ratted for, you know, 4 years, and like 50% of this stuff could go and I wouldn't care.
You wouldn't care. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yep. Kiwi Graham in the live chat brings up something that came to my mind and left it almost as quickly when I was first answering Andrew's question, which was he said, and I don't know if this was included, but he said he had a 1 terabyte drive with about 250 gigs used. Is that a spinning drive or is it an SSD? I am not sure if in 2019 you could still buy an iMac with a spinning drive, but if it is a spinning drive, that will have a performance impact, negative performance impact.
Huge one, yeah.
Yeah, especially on database intensive operations, which is what searching is now, right? You know, so it. But,
oh,
right.
What size is the drive?
1 terabyte.
If he has the base model, that's a 5400 RPM SATA drive.
Okay, so.
I just checked Mac Tracker.
All right.
I'm assuming he has the 4K Retina 2.5-inch.
Yeah.
I think that's the only one that offered the Core i3.
Okay. All right. So.
And it's the early 2019 because they also did a 5K 27-inch in 2019.
Correct. Yeah. I had the 5K here. I still have the 5K. Something in me like has hope that it's just going to miraculously.
That's together. A Core i5. So the Core i3 is the base model 4K 21.5-inch. And the base storage is a SATA drive. The other 1 terabyte option would be a Fusion drive, which is still
mostly spinning, right? Yeah. All right. So, new advice: buy an SSD, connect it to the Thunderbolt port on that thing, and clone. Or, well, cloning is not. Could he clone with Big Sur? Maybe. Yeah. If you can't clone, you know, reinstall and migrate over to that. Things are going to get faster, and that will breathe new life into that machine for you, guaranteed.
Yeah, I mean, you can carbon copy clone or whatever.
Well, but you can't with Sonoma. Like, you can't clone to a new boot drive. It ain't quite as easy as it used to be.
Still. Or if you're really brave, you know, you can open that thing up and put an SSD in it. But that's what I had to do with my wife's, you know, we had an Intel Mac Mini or whatever, and like, it changed the world.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. You can go back to the episodes. It's probably 12 years ago now or something on this show where we started migrating our machines to SSDs. And it was like, finally our computers would use their CPUs. Like, prior to that, everything was I/O bound. Rarely did you see your Mac use its CPU, and then it was like you got freed up the I/O. It was like, boom, good to go.
Yeah. 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 Start there. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And just do the external thing because it's easy, it's and fine. And Thunderbolt has plenty of the bandwidth that you're going to get so much more performance over the spinning drive internally, even though, because like, people start to freak out about the whole bus thing, and it's not going to be your bottleneck.
That's not going to be your issue. That's correct. Yeah. Thank you, Kiwi Grim. This is one of the things I really love about the Mac Geek Gab community in general, and specifically about having so many of you join us when we do the show because these kinds of things come to mind. And I made the incorrect assumption. I could have checked Mac Tracker when I was answering Andrew's question, but I was like in like blazing through mode. I'm like, ah, there's no way they released a computer in 2019 that had a spindle drive. Well, Dave was wrong. Told you I was wrong before and that I would be wrong again. Who knew? It's going to be right away. Yeah, that's where I would start for sure, especially since you've exhausted all these other things. I mean, you know, spending money is spending money. You don't want to do it willy-nilly, but and I still think, you know, here's the thing. Unless you can clone to that, migrating to it will naturally cause you to do a reinstall of the operating system and then migrate things over with, like, you know, Migration Assistant, which will work almost perfectly in most cases. So it really won't hurt all that much. But that's not a nuke and pave. Migration Assistant is its own thing, but it will get you there quickly. That would be worth trying, right? You know,
that's
just
the way to do it.
Just do that. Yeah, install the OS on the spindle drive. Let Migration Assistant take your data over. Install OS on the install the new OS on the SSD. Let Migration Assistant slurp things over. And my guess is that your problems will be
your life will change.
Yeah, you may not solve this
sooner.
You may not solve the problem, but you might mitigate the symptoms of it this way. Hal has our next question. He says, and I'm curious about M1's future. I have three M1 Macs, Mac Studio, a 14-inch MacBook Pro, and an 11-inch iPad Pro. Okay. All M1 with 1 terabyte storage. I just use Lightroom for photography. That is all. I don't do any video editing. My question, how long will the M1 chip handle this basic photo editing and receive continued Apple support? Maybe move up to the M3 or the M2. I still have a 2017 Intel iMac, and it's still going just fine. Yeah, great. Okay, good. he says it's a backup only. And Adam, I'm glad to have you here, says Hal. And I agree with Hal. Yeah. So
glad to be here.
Yeah. Thoughts on this, Adam?
Yeah, so my immediate thought was, I don't know how many people know about Apple's sort of terminology for either vintage or obsolete products. So bottom line is, I don't think you have to worry too much about M1 going away anytime soon, because Apple has two things where they have vintage products and obsolete products.
Yep.
And vintage products are basically covered in terms of, like, you can take them to an Apple store, you can repair them, you can go to Apple service providers, they're going to have parts for them for like 5 years.
Products are considered vintage when Apple stopped distributing them for sale more than five and less than seven.
Between five and seven years.
Yep.
And as we know, like, operating system updates go back 4 or 5 years too. So, like, you're going to be able to upgrade your operating system for at least 4 or 5 years. And then, you know, after 7 years, that's when things get obsolete. And that's when I would really kind of start to worry. But, you know, like, M1 is still like a great processor. And if you were to buy one, I wouldn't even have any qualms about recommending to someone, especially someone who might be on a tight budget. You can still find M1 Max out there and you can get great deals on them. And they're going to go for 3, 4, 5 years. You're going to be just fine.
Oh, I agree.
In my opinion.
The Mac Studio that I'm running here in the studio to replace the aforementioned lightning struck iMac is an M1 Max. It's the base model Mac Studio with a 512 gig SSD, and it's great. I looked in Mac Tracker to see when this clock would start for the M1 in general, which I think is an important marker here, right? So the M1 Mini was sold up until January of 2023. The M1 Mac Studio through June of 23, and the M1 iMac was sold up until October of 23. So I think for M1 in general, October of 2023 is when this 5-year clock is going to start. I know that there were others that stopped being M1 prior to that, but M1 is M1, especially with Mac OS, right? So October of 2023, that means we've got until fall of 2028 before Apple is off the hook for M1 in general. I think we're going to be all right for a while. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So. I mean, I was going to mention, I guess we're going to talk a little bit later, so maybe I should save this. I'm going to save it for later, but okay. I'll talk about some of my technology that I still use a little bit later, I think.
All right. Okay, great. All right. Well, yeah. Shall we proceed into later? Do you want to read Jim's question for us?
Yeah, yeah. I guess okay. Not that much later.
It's not that much later. Here we are.
Yeah, Jim has a great size. And it's actually for you, Dave. He says, Dave, I'm considering getting a Synology disk station. I can say that word. With the main use being backup and to stream media, photos, videos for family and friends. I take a lot of photos and videos and share them with family and friends and groups I'm associated with. I have a few questions regarding this, and I'm hoping you can help answer. I'm sure Dave can. I would like to take photos, videos of events, and then post them for others to view or download. Can I allow access to a media folder with both videos and photos that others can view if they have a URL to access this folder? And can you share individual files? Can home videos be streamed? Would Video Station be used to stream share media files? Is there a cost for that software? Are the disk stations noisy, have running fan, or relatively quiet? I'm considering the DS-423 with four bays, so I would have plenty of room for backing up files and sharing streaming media. I could use RAID 5 or 3 on the drives for backup and have one drive by itself sharing my media. Oh, can I think he's asking. Or do all four drives need to be set up on RAID 5? Or is that the best way to set it up? I currently have a Flickr account where I share my media files, but home videos are limited to size and length. I'd rather not pay an annual subscription for Flickr if I can do the same thing myself with no limit on streaming videos. Is Synology a good solution for what I'm trying to do? Or should I just stick with Flickr? I appreciate your feedback since you are familiar with the disk stations.
I am all too familiar with the disk stations. I have a little story to tell about my 20-minute ordeal on Saturday afternoon that turned into 6 hours, but I'll save that. With my disk station, this was a self-inflicted thing. Yes. So I think the DS-423 Plus, that's the model. There is no DS-423, just for everybody's benefit if you wind up searching for this. I think the DS-423 Plus is a fantastic disk station for most of us here in the Mac Geek Gab community. It's got, like you said, it's got four bays. It's got a decent CPU in there to handle, like you can run some Docker containers on that CPU. You can run, you know, the things you want to run. It is an Intel CPU with a GPU, which means it has the capability of doing hardware transcoding, which can be important, especially in your scenario where you want to provide videos for family and friends. Having the disk station able to do that hardware transcoding if they're on a bandwidth limited connection back to you, super important. So there's all like a lot of reasons that I love the DS-423 Plus. Really great disk station. I would, as far as answering your questions in reverse, I would almost always, unless there is an extenuating circumstance and nothing you described would fall into this category for me, I would always set up all of the disks as one array, one, and arguably one volume too. I wouldn't split the volumes. I would make one array of all the disks. I would not have one disk for media and the other three disks for whatever else you're doing. Do all four of them or three of them or two of them. You don't have to fill it out of the gate. You can put two disks in and then add a third when you need more storage and add a fourth when you need more storage. And I would not use RAID 5. You could, and there's nothing wrong with RAID 5 except that you can't use different sized disks with RAID 5. If you have, let's say you put two terabyte disks in, let's say, well, that even if you call it RAID 5, if you just have two disks, one disk is always dedicated to fault tolerance with RAID 5, which means you would get 2 terabytes of storage and you would have one disk for fault tolerance. However, if you added a third 2 terabyte disk, you would have one disk for fault tolerance and now 4 terabytes available for your storage. We're still on RAID 5, if you then added a 4 terabyte drive, you would only add 2 more terabytes of storage. 2 terabytes on that 4 terabyte drive would remain unused until you replaced all of the other three drives with drives that were at least 4 terabytes in size. So the smallest drive in the array defines how all of the drives are going to be seen. That is not true with something called Synology Hybrid RAID, or SHR as they call it. That gives you the option of using mixed disk sizes within one disk station, within one array. And for most home users is what I would recommend, because it allows you the flexibility of kind of using drives that you get over time. And as you replace drives, you start replacing them with larger drives, and over time your array will just grow. And that's wonderful. So that out of the way, for video streaming, yep, this device will do it. You can use Video Station or Plex even. It's available for free. Could be, and you can pay for additional features, but Plex, I would use Plex to do this, but you can run both Plex and Video Station on the same disk station, pointing to the same media library. Like, that you don't have to keep two copies of your media library. You can literally have one. You point both of them to that folder, and it works just fine. As for noise, so yes, the DS423 Plus is going to have a fan, and that fan can be set to like loud mode, medium mode, or quiet mode. The fan is not going to be your problem. That's relatively quiet, and it's nice, consistent, easy white noise. Those disks that you put in there, however, are going to be a different story. Unless you choose to put SSDs in, those disks are noisy. Adam, you have experience with this too?
Well, yeah, because my Synology sits in our living room, and you know, my wife would be like, "What's that noise?" And I'm like, "It's
yeah, yep, 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 okay. Yep." It's the disks are noisy. When I moved the disk stations last year, maybe a year before, from my office to the kind of a basement closet in our house, playroom closet, really, in our house, simply because we put a generator in, like a standby generator in at the house. And I thought, well, this is where I want all the network stuff. And it took me a couple of weeks to get used to the new, much lower, much more consistent ambient volume level in my office. It was like, something's wrong. Like I thought, like, it felt like the power was out, even though of course the lights were on, everything was fine. But yeah, those things are noisy. So if you can avoid putting it in your living room, that is a good thing, and or your bedroom. But you could put SSDs in this, and then all you would have is the noise of the fan. You'd also maybe have to just eat ramen for a little while to yeah, offset the expense.
Second mortgage.
Yeah, exactly. But the answer to everything is, yeah, man, this is what a disk station is for. And it's a great entry point to getting a disk station. There's so much more you can do with it. And as I said, the 423 Plus is super capable. So and Synology software is really where they shine. We actually have a lot of complaints, comments perhaps, about how their hardware is underpowered. It's sort of a known thing in the industry. The holy grail for all of us is Synology software and QNAP's hardware, right? That would be great. And it turns out we might get something approximating that from Ugreen. The Ugreen brand new, not even in the market yet, NASYNC, NASYNC, is coming. I've been paying very close attention to this since CES. I actually had a conversation with them last week. I've got one on the way, but the people in charge of this project have worked at Synology, they've worked at QNAP, and they've worked at Seagate. So they know they really understand what people like us want, and they know that there's a gap in the market. So I'm eagerly awaiting I know right out of the gate the Ugreen one isn't going to be right. So right now I wouldn't recommend buying it unless you want it to just tinker with. But over the next 12 months, as the software for this thing matures and everything kind of comes around, it's going to start getting interesting. So anyway, that's a departure. The Synology software is great. It will give you as many Saturday afternoons of tinkering fun as you care to spend with it and tweak. And you can add all kinds of different little server things. It's super fun. So I think you're going to have fun with it. As to the last question, is this easier than Flickr? No, Flickr's already working for you. There's no friction, no time, and just the annual expense of maintaining the status quo with Flickr. So I can't with a straight face say, of course this is better. No, well, it's not easier. Whether it's better or not depends on whether, of course, I like hosting the stuff myself. I like managing it. I like tinkering with it most of the time. Hopefully that helps. You which disk station? We gotta upgrade you, right? You have a
15-13 plus.
How many disks do you have plus in that?
I think four.
Okay.
There's four.
Because maybe we need to send you a 423 plus. That's kind of what I'm
thinking. And I have two broken drive doors that we talked about. I gotta get the little latch. I gotta order this little latch.
Well, you don't have to order it if we wind up getting you a 423 plus, because that might be the magic answer here. So
I was looking at that exact model. It was interesting that he brought that up. Yeah, but I run a lot of old technology around here. I realized, you know, we were talking earlier about when to upgrade to your Intel Mac. So I thought every time I've been in here, there's a fan noise, and I always thought it was my Drobo under the desk. And I went and turned off the Drobo today, and I still hear the fan noise. And I'm like, oh, I had a spinning backup drive that I use for just like a Seagate drive that I use for. And I'm like, oh, I wonder if that has a fan in it. So I unplugged that. Still a fan noise. It's my Intel. It's my Intel Mac.
Oh, of course it is.
Just like, Yeah. So there's that. Until I moved here 2 years ago, I was using a USB 4-bay Drobo, like an original Drobo, connected to a Intel Core Duo, not even Core 2 Duo, Mac Mini as a network backup storage facility. And it was stuck running Snow Leopard, I think, was the last operating system it would run on. But I was running that up until 2 years ago, and it's sitting in the box here. It would still run. I could probably hook it up and still do the same thing. I was using ChronoSync, and ChronoSync has, I can't remember what it's called, but they have like a networking software that you can use to go across the network. And that works great. So, you know, I am the king of like holding on to old technology for way too long and continue to use it. But yeah, I mean, that Synology is running great too. It does everything I need it to do. And the only complaint I had was I couldn't figure out Plex. But then what I didn't realize, as we talked about on a previous episode, is that I needed to update the core software. Because I didn't realize it wouldn't tell me that, oh, you're on 6, you can now go to 7. It did the auto updates up within whatever version it was.
Yes.
And then I didn't know I could even download and install like,
you can run DSM-7 on the 15-13 plus. That's amazing.
So.
That's great. Synology, their support is like their support for their devices is amazing. Like the fact that you can run the current operating system on these devices that are ancient and out of warranty and out of any sort of support, it speaks a lot to how they are as a company. And if you emailed them for support with that, I would be almost certain that they would engage and answer and help you, even though it's way out of warranty. Like I've had them go, and we've heard this from all of you folks too. You know, they go out of their way for this. So it's,
I'm running 7.7.1.1.
Yeah.
Whatever. 1.1.1.
It's amazing.
Update 6.
That's amazing.
So, and that brought my Plex back. So now I'm happy. Like it's fine. Other than the little hardware failure.
Yeah, right. But that's like physical hardware failure that your drive doors won't close. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just took the empty ones and I've swapped them.
Of course. Yes.
So they're just the empty bays that are popped open.
I had never heard of that until you mentioned it, you know, whatever, 3, 4, 5 weeks ago, whatever it was. And then I was doing an inventory of disk stations that I like old disk stations that I have here. And I was going through one of them and just making sure I hadn't left like a drive in it or anything before I gave Pete this old one that he's now using for like a data storage thing, which is great. It's nice to see it back in service. And as I was going through, you know, I just pop the drives and put it, take it out, make sure there's nothing in the tray, pop it back in and lock it. And one of them, it was totally fine until I touched it and I opened it up. It was like, okay, great. And I close it and won't close. And I'm like, oh, that's weird. And then I was like, friggin' Adam cursed me. Like, I've never experienced this. I've had so many disc stations over the years, and now I get this. Yep.
Here's the thing with mine. They did it on their own. Like, they were just sitting there, and they just, one day I walked up and one was popped open and I couldn't close it.
Yeah.
And then about a month later, another one did it.
Wow.
And I was like, what the heck is going on here? Like, they just failed on their own. Like, no one touches that thing. No one goes over there.
Right.
I mean, unless the cats bumped it and then did it, but I highly doubt it.
I doubt it. Yeah. I will share a PSA here about anyone migrating from one disc station to another. Something I have done countless times without any issues whatsoever. So much so that I'm super confident about the process. And Synology makes it easy. If you have, let's say you have like, you know, three bay array and whatever size disc station it might be, you know, it could be a 4-bay, it could be an 8-bay. It doesn't matter. You can take those discs, move them into a new disc station, fire it up, and it'll say, hey, I see that you're moving this from a, you know, whatever you used to have to whatever this current model is. Do you want to do that? And you say yes. And then it asks you another question. Do you want to start from scratch with your system but keep your data? Or do you just want to basically keep everything, including all your settings and your users and everything, and just run what you ran over there over here without having to do anything else? And so, obviously, I always choose that. And then it says, great, I'm going to download the software for it. It downloads the software, updates itself, reboots, and literally in like 20 minutes, you're back up and running. It's amazing, right? It's awesome. So on Saturday, we got home. We went out to lunch. We got home from lunch. And I'm like, you know, I've been wanting to roll one of my disc stations to a newer one that I have here. I need to test. Okay, great. I'm like, I told Lisa, I don't even know if I told her I'm going to take 20 minutes. But I knew it was going to be 20 minutes. So I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to do this. And so I go into the playroom. I shut down the old disc station. I had my laptop downstairs already. I was kind of thinking about doing this. And I shut it down. I put the... move the drives. And the one thing, and I did this, this was not my problem. You have to keep the drives in the same order. So drive one is drive one, drive two is drive two. If you mess that up, that's on you. So I know this, I've done this many times. I'm very diligent. Okay. So I did that, came up, got the screen, answered the question, starts downloading the software. The download is corrupted. What? Okay. Well, fine, whatever. All right, let's do it again. You know, so back through, download it, restart it, you know, fine, come up, starts downloading. The download is corrupted. Okay, so I go to the website, I download the software manually because you can do that too. You can, you know, it's all just in a web browser. So, okay, again, one more time, I upload. Your system volume is full. Like, oh no, I've heard about this. Oh no. So now I have, there's your main volume that has, you know, terabytes and terabytes of data. And then there's a tiny little sliver that they carve out for the system volume, and it's put on every disk. So if you lose a disk, you still have your system volume. It's a RAID 1. It's a mirror across all of them. And that system volume was full. It turns out Synology used to, and so therefore my older RAID has this size, 2.3 gigabytes of a system volume. The new ones, if you were to set up a disk station today, it would give you an 8 gigabyte system volume. I would argue it should be 100, but be that as it may, it needed about 750 megabytes to download and unpack, like unzip the update file. And, you know, things like, if you know anything about Unix, var log is stored on the system volume. The slash user and slash etsy directories are stored on the system. So there's like things there. And there's even some app packages there. I spent 6 hours on Saturday. And I, by hour five and a half to our previous story, I gave up. I was like, I cannot solve this. And I texted Lisa. I started kind of keeping her up to date. Like, I'm sorry. Here's where we are. I hadn't even like gone upstairs since we got home from lunch. And I'm like, I have two more things I'm going to try. It's going to take 15 minutes and then I'm done. And thankfully, the first one of those actually worked. But it was, you know, it was just that constant process. I learned on Saturday how to hot mount a Synology volume in. I built like a new disk station with a single drive to just get it up and running. And then while it's on, I pushed all of my disks in from the old one and was able to hot mount the system volume that way. It was a whole thing. I learned more Unix than I wanted to learn. And I knew I was playing with fire, right? I knew that anything I did could be the last thing I ever did with this volume, right? But thankfully, I was able to clear off enough stuff from that system volume to fix it. My advice to everyone is if you know how to go and check how much space is on your system volume, do that before you migrate to a new disk station. Definitely. And if you don't know how to do that, open a Synology support ticket, tell them what you're about to do. It's going to take a few days for them to reply. Have them go in, look at your system volume, clean out the things that they know are safe to clean out. So you're not guessing like Dave was on Saturday afternoon, and have them prep you for this upgrade. And then you'll be fine. Like, if I had gone in advance, this would have, instead of being a 20-minute process, it would have been a 25-minute process. Like, it really would have been trivial. If I knew how much space I needed and what to do to get there, which I now know, it would have been fine. But instead, I did not proactively do this, and I lost, you know, an entire Saturday afternoon. Sure, I learned some things, and here's a valuable story, and I can go tell Lisa, no, it was good. I talked about it on the show. But yeah, so be aware and really engage Synology support if you're going to do this. So that's my PSA. So, yep.
Cool.
Yep. But don't let this dissuade you. And they are aware of this problem. One thing that I noticed, I have four disks in this array. Two of them have 8 gigabytes reserved for the system partition. Two of them have 2.3. So my system partition is 2.3, as we talked about before. You know, it's a mirrored thing, so the smallest size wins. But once I replace the other two drives over time, my system partition on this array will grow to 8 gigabytes. So, and if you were to start up a new one right now, you'd get 8 gigs, and in theory, that's enough. I'd like about 50 or 100, just plenty of breathing room. Storage is cheap.
Dave, you want to talk about Synology for a little bit?
No. Why, do you have a question?
No.
Okay. Shall we do some cool stuff found, Adam?
I think we should, hopefully.
I agree. All right. Listener Dave tells us about a new thing that he found. It's called stash.new. He says, it's a well-thought-out alternative for Google Docs. He says, you go to stash.new or StashPad. I guess you go to either one. It seems let me confirm this before I do the thing. Yeah, stash.new will bring you to docs.stashpad.com. Okay, so he says, here are the number of steps to make a new shareable document in Google Docs. First, you got to be signed in. Second, you got to go to Google Docs, create a new document, share, make a title for it, save it, test it, go into the sharing thing, change restricted to anyone with the link, copy the link, and you're done. Okay, so he counted all that out. That's 11 steps. The number of steps to make a shareable document on StashPad. In your browser, type stash.new. Number 2, click the paperclip looking icon in the top, and you're done. 3 steps, including, and you're done, which was the 11th step in the other one too. So he says the speed of their site is remarkable and the learning curve feels like zero. I dug into this and he's totally right. It's a very cool alternative. I, of course, was wondering, okay, what's the longevity of this company? What's the privacy? Who are they? All of this. And thankfully, Dave from Houston, but now living in Lisbon, Portugal, had already done some of this work. And he says it's an early stage startup based in Durham, North Carolina, the other Durham, one of the other Durhams. The founders used to be engineers at Twilio and Nextdoor. They're backed by Precursor Ventures and people who have helped build Twilio, Slack, Superhuman, GitHub, and others. So he says their privacy pages looked pretty good and all that stuff. So thank you for that, Dave. Yeah, fun stuff. Stash.new.
Cool.
Yeah, free. It's, or so it seems. So that's, you know, we like that.
Free for now.
Free for now. Yeah. Yeah. Porthos John is going to make us all spend some money. He says, I'm in one of our remote offices today. And when I arrived at the hotel, I realized that I brought my travel kit to charge my phone, watch, and AirPods, but had forgotten my power adapter for my Mac and iPad. Off to Best Buy I went, and he says, I found the coolest, lightest, thinnest power brick with included two outlet extension that I have seen. He says, it wasn't cheap, but it's easy to use. It's the Anker, it's the A9-126-1F1-GAN-Prime 100-watt charging station. Regularly $65 on Amazon. He said that day it was $10 off. Now it's at $90 on Amazon. This thing, I have the, the one that he mentioned is still that. There's a 140-watt version. So I have the one he talked about, which is this very cool thing. It's about the size of an iPhone. And it's including its thickness. But it has on its face, it has two 3-prong USAC outlets. And what's cool is when you plug into one of them, the outlet lifts out of the adapters to make it deep enough to plug into, which is cool. And then on the end, it has two USB-C and two USB-A power ports as well. This is what I travel with. I used this for all of the trips that I had recently, and I love it. It's exactly this. The 140-watt one that he found, in addition to being 140 watts, has a screen on it that shows you how much power each port is consuming. And because it's going to be used in hotel rooms, the screen is not on all the time. It has a little button you can push to turn the screen on and, of course, off, so that you aren't stuck with this glowing, beautiful light of nerdness that is going to be so delicious. So I definitely need to upgrade to this for the screen alone, for sure. Like, there's zero question that I'll need this in my travel kit. And I'm bummed that I didn't know about it before I started my Q1 travel extravaganza, because I don't have a reason to use it for a little while. But I will. There'll be more. So $89 for the one with the screen on Amazon. We'll put a link in the show notes. It looks delicious.
That's worth it. It's First Friday.
It's First Friday. Yes.
And I know this because it's 10 a.m. and the air raid siren just went off. So if anybody hears that, I apologize.
We do hear that. Yeah, we have not. There was one time in the past where you mentioned that it was going off and we couldn't hear it. But this time we get to hear it. So yeah, that Anker thing, right? Though, like, look at the
oh, yeah, shoe. Yeah. I had something similar to that years ago, not with the USB stuff, but just a nice portable thing. Yeah. And it was great for carrying around, and I could share it with people in Starbucks and stuff like that. It was great.
Yeah. Look at that air raid siren. I love that. I love it. We got time for another cool stuff found or two. Listener Ben tells us about our next one, and as soon as I find it here, I will pull it up. He says, my M2 Air has the tendency to be slow to reconnect to Wi-Fi after waking from sleep. This is odd to me, since PowerNap works and evidence reveals that it has been connected during sleep. Nonetheless, I found some steps in an article to build a sleep watcher automation that power cycles my Wi-Fi on every wake of my MacBook Air, and the problem is solved. And so we will link to this Sleep Watcher thing. It's Sleep Watcher is a command line tool that monitors the sleep, wake up, and idleness of a Mac. and can be used to execute a Unix command, which of course can then trigger, you know, a shortcut or whatever you want from there. So that's, and we've got links to Sleepwatcher and then also to the script that Ben found that actually does the swapping of the toggling of the Wi-Fi. So thank you for that, Ben. I love nerdy things like that. See, only one of our cool stuff found today so far is going to cost any of us any money. So that's not bad, right?
Yeah, that's good. I'm just wondering how long this siren goes for.
I will share one other cool stuff found that I will audible into our ever-growing list of cool stuff found. I was talking to our friend Jeff Gamet last night, and he was talking about TextBlaze, which is, in a sense, a text expander type tool but it's got so many extra things in it. It's got templates and scripting, and he says it's what he always wanted text expander to be. So I figured I would share that here too. I have not used it yet, but it sure looks pretty interesting. So we will put that in the show notes too. So yeah, I love things like that. I still use a combination of text expander and Apple's built-in text expansion thing. I like Apple's built-in one because it's part of my iOS keyboard by default, but for the advanced stuff I use text expander. I'm surprised that I haven't moved any of that into Keyboard Maestro. You know, just because it's always running for me, Keyboard Maestro is. So
yeah, I use the same combo. I still have the text expander keyboard on my iOS devices and use it a little bit. I wish Apple would fix that. Like, I don't know if they can.
Right.
You know, the not separate keyboard thing. But I mean, on my Mac.
Yes. Right.
Text expander all the time. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Text expander is there all the time on the Mac. It can only be there with a separate keyboard on iOS, or you can launch the app, and the app is even more full featured. Like, if I need to do a one of those things with fill in forms or whatever, the app is absolutely the way to go. But there is no Keyboard Maestro app for iPhone. So perhaps that answers my own question as to why I haven't moved this stuff into Keyboard Maestro. But I like the Apple stuff for the simple things because it's always right there. Like, you know, phone numbers, email addresses, those sorts of things. I highly recommend building snippets for that. So, all right.
For those for those playing at home, 4 minutes is how long that iterates.
I think if they were actually playing along at home, they would have calculated that already.
And that's the tornado warning siren. So we appreciate it.
Yeah, and it happens once per month just to test it.
The first Friday of every month at 10 a.m.
All right.
They run that thing, and it's loud because, again, it's about 200 yards from my house. So, and it spins around, so it gets louder when it points towards me, and then less loud when it goes.
It Dopplers. Yeah.
Yeah, and it sounds just like a World War II air raid bomb siren.
Is it an old world, like a repurposed World War II? Like, I mean, you know, why wouldn't it be, right? When in our town that I grew up in, we had a volunteer fire department, and I think they still do. And so they would test that occasionally, and then also there were times where it wasn't a test. But right. I got so used to hearing it that I wouldn't even register. I'd have a friend over at the house. They'd be like, "What is that? What do you mean? That's the thing." They're like, "What do you mean? What do you mean? It's like super loud." Because again, we were about as close to it as it sounds like you are to yours. But I was like, it's just fine. It's fine. It's
normal. It'll be important for us if a real event happens because we don't have a basement. So we have to go just a block over to the police station, basically security center. And they have a shelter there. So
that's good.
Knock on wood, we've not had to do that. The only time I ever hear it is first Friday. And that's when I hope I only ever hear it.
Let's hope it stays that way. Yeah. That house that I grew up in, we also had a bomb shelter in our basement. It was, you know, the house was built in the 40s. So it was like they thought that that would help protect against, like, you know, nuclear attack. Obviously, we've learned a little since then, but seemed like a good idea at the time. So we had this little bomb shelter, you know, just more cement. That's all.
Out here in, I think it's in a more western South Dakota, and I forget where the place is, but there is a company that is now selling. We had the largest munitions storage facility in the entire United States, and it's now been decommissioned.
Yep.
And some company bought it, and they're selling out them as shelters because they literally are. Will survive a nuclear bomb kind of shelter. So yeah, that's interesting. They just sell the empty shell, and then you can do whatever you want on the inside, and they're building a whole community out there. So
that's cool. All right. I guess it's that
time. If you need it.
Yep. Time to bring the band in. Thanks for hanging out with us, everybody. Thank you for sending in all your stuff to feedback@macgeekgab.com. Right, Adam?
Yeah, that is feedback@macgeekgab.com.
It's feedback@macgeekgab.com. Thanks to Cashfly for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Make sure you missed hearing Pete on the show this week, so make sure to go listen to his show, So There I Was. They just hit their 100th episode, which is absolutely amazing. And thanks to, but congratulations to Dave Ginsberg for hitting the 300th episode of In Touch with iOS. That's pretty amazing.
Oh, cool.
I know. Yeah, it's pretty cool. So go check that out, too. We'll put links to all these things in the show notes for you. Yeah, that's it. Thanks for hanging out. We'll see you next week. And thanks to our sponsors. Of course, you can always learn about our sponsors at macgeekgab.com/sponsors. And that has all the links for everything. And today, of course, linkedin.com/MGG and barebones.com. So our thanks to them. Our thanks to you. It really does help us if you go check them out. And that's it. Yeah. Adam, I know my shirt says that I'm routinely disruptive and that your shirt is flannel. Pete's not here with his shirt. What does his shirt usually say? I forget.
Oh, man. Don't get caught.
Made up.
That's some good advice. Later.